Okay.
Now, we are not told to do that.
All right. You are not recommended.
Now he is done in this world. You should help him. You're just having fun for yourself.
All right.
And so the question, the main question is that why? I want to answer this question. Why Sakarat al-Maut? Why should we experience this kind of sakra or this special hardness, hardship? So, you know, the answer is that imagine a surgery. If the one has a tumor in the brain, I don't know, or in the his stomach.
Yes.
So when he needs a surgery, and the surgery will be harder when the tumor is bigger. The bigger tumor, the harder surgery.
All right.
That tumor is our sins. When I gathered a lot of sins, these like gathering a lot of viruses or infections in my body.
All right.
You know, we are gathering and collecting a lot of viruses and dirt and infection in our souls.
That's right.
Making that to a tumor. And when we are dying, the surgery starts.
All right.
That tumor should be taken out. So because you made that tumor bigger, so your surgery should be harder.
Harder, that's
why
right.
Why not?
Okay.
We shouldn't complain. You know, the one, the angel, is taking my soul harder than the other one.
All right.
Like the doctor who cut the stomach or cut the brain or skull of that one harder and more. You know, the doctor is not brutal. The doctor is kind.
Yes.
Doctor is helping him.
Yes.
The problem is from himself.
All right.
He didn't care about his health. So that is physical health. And now we're talking about spiritual health. So heart sakratul maut is because of our sins. And God is cleaning us by that hardship. Yes, we can think now, we can start. We can think about our death. And now the time that we can make it easy.
Okay.
Not at that time.
And especially for those who are very much attached to the materialistic world.
Yes, exactly.
Leaving this world will be a very difficult one, okay?
Yes.
So because the soul is very much connected and affiliated with the mundane world, materialistic world, you know, the love for these attachments in this world.
As much as you make this connection stronger, cutting this connection
will be harder.
It is like that.
That's right.
Do not make it so strong. Yes, we are connected to material world, but use it as it's necessary.
Okay.
As much as it's necessary.
Yes.
Do not make it stronger than necessary.
So a spirit can be connected to materialistic world too.
Yeah, why not?
I mean, because when we are talking about materialistic, we are talking about physical things. But the spirit can have root in the materialistic world too, to be connected very much, so that separating the two will be
like different kinds of glue. You want to attach something to other things.
All right.
What kind of glue you use?
Are you using? That's
right. Yes. When the glue is harder, cutting this connection will be harder. Soul and body is like that.
Okay, that's it. So, Shaykh Danish, now, one of the major questions is that are there any deeds we must do in order to make our, we can say, separation from this world or the time of death a little bit easier for us?
Yes. In fact, in the riwayas, a lot of good deeds have been mentioned that make it easier for a person to die peacefully or the, not feel the same level or amount of pain.
All right.
So from the riwayas, we can say that sila-e-rahim, meeting and doing good to your relatives, having a constant connection with your relatives is mentioned. Your good deeds towards your parents, your mother and your father. And even in one of the riwayas, it is mentioned that if a person's mother is not pleased with him and is not happy with that person, they will have a difficulty in giving and detaching themselves from this world.
Very good.
Then we have love for Imam Ali alayhi salam. Love for Imam Ali alayhi salam is going to make it easy for a person, the believer, to die peacefully. Then going a lot for the ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, or even performing the ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam has been mentioned. So all of these good deeds, we see that a lot of them is about hukukun nas, right?
Yes.
Or hukuk al-imam. And because we say that hukukullah may be forgiven, but hukukun nas is what is going to be difficult for
a
person
That's right.
without the permission of that person. So the most important people after the Aima alayhimus salam are our parents.
Yes.
And so if we are respectful towards our parents, we perform the duties we owe them, it is going to make it easier for us to part from this world. Even some of the surahs of the Holy Quran have been mentioned. Suratul Yasin, Surah Yasin has been mentioned in the riwayas. Surah Safat specifically has been mentioned from Imam Al-Kazim alayhi salam, who says that reciting Surah Safat near a person who is going to or is feeling the sakaratul maut is going to ease his pain. And so all of these are basically a connection from this world to the other world, and have been narrated to us in the riwayah.
You know, there's a riwayah from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that Shaykh Mufid narrated that once a young person was dying, he was in sakaratul maut, and it was very hard for him. You know, my brother mentioned the riwayah of parents.
That's right.
I remember that. That they asked Prophet to be beside that person in order to have an easier death.
Kind of death, that's right.
But Prophet was watching him, that it was very hard for him.
All right.
Prophet told him, say La ilaha illallah. He couldn't say. And repeated that. He couldn't say. Prophet asked him, does he have any mother? The mother is alive or not? They said, yes, he does. Prophet said, go and bring the mother. They brought the mother, and Prophet asked him, are you satisfied with him? The mother said, no. He was not good with me. Because of that, the mouth was so hard for him.
Wow.
Prophet asked him, forgive your son.
Ask her, that's
right. Ask her, the mother, forgive the son. After she, the mother, forgave the child just because of Prophet. Wow. Just for the respect of Prophet. She forgave the son. She could die very easily. And the sacred mouth was taken from him. That is the position and status of our parents.
All right.
Even affecting on our death.
That's right. Respect the parents. Respect the parents. Kiss the hands of your mothers. Kiss the feet of your father. This is what mentioned, you know, in Kitab Jam al-Sa'adat by the late Nawawi, that if your mother is dissatisfied with you, sakarat al-maut would be really difficult for you, okay?
Yeah.
So mother has great status in your life, okay? So, and make them happy, inshallah, and the go to your mothers, you know, and kiss their hands and let them be happy with you, inshallah. You will have easier time of death. So this is mother. Thank you very much, Shaykh Fadai. Sheikh Danish, for a nice elaboration regarding Sakarat al-Maut. It was very kind of you. Thank you much, dear listeners. For any information or more information, please visit our website, iranradio.ir. Also send us your questions and comments at iranradio@sinairabi.ir email. So, till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Professor Mearshammer, welcome here, my dear friend. Before we talk about can Europe save Ukraine, I just finished reading a great piece that you wrote. It may have been derived from a speech that you gave on the bleak future that Europe has. But before we get there, our dear friend and colleague Alistair Crook is reporting that Israeli press is reporting that Prime Minister Netanyahu is threatening Israeli President Herzog over the issue of the pardon, and contrary to Israeli law, is unwilling to admit guilt and unwilling to leave public office. I'm going to guess that you're not surprised by any of this.
Hardly at all. I mean, Netanyahu is someone who is deeply committed to remaining in office for as long as he possibly can. And as we've talked about on the show, he's done a brilliant job at prolonging his tenure as prime minister, given the fact that he was the prime minister on October 7th when Israel was caught by surprise and suffered that devastating defeat that day. And furthermore, given that he has been under indictment and has been in court for well over a year now, the fact that he survived is quite remarkable. He has no intention of leaving office. So he'll cut a deal, but it's only if it's a deal that leaves him in office and basically leaves him unscathed.
I'm going to guess that this doesn't surprise you either. The Financial Times is reporting that Arab leaders have told President Trump that they will not accept Tony Blair on the so-called Trump Peace Board, and they absolutely reject him. I'm trying to say this with a straight face as the governor general. I can't imagine that. He's going to live in Gaza anyway. They're going to reject him as the governor general of Gaza.
No, it's very interesting. This Haaretz has a big piece today that says in the headline that Tony Blair has been visiting Netanyahu since October 7th on a frequent basis.
I saw that.
Yeah. So, I mean, this guy is in bed with the Israelis. The idea that he's going to be the one who administers Gaza. I mean, when you think about what's going on with regard to Gaza, it's really quite amazing. The two principal negotiators for the United States are Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who are dyed-in-the-wool Zionists. They should not be negotiating for the United States with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then you throw in Tony Blair, who's not much different than Kushner and Witkoff. This looks like a colonial enterprise, what Trump is trying to do in Gaza. There's no self-determination whatsoever for the Palestinians in this deal that he's concocted for Gaza. There's no political horizon. There's no self-determination. Basically, he's going to have a bunch of Europeans running it, and he's going to be nominally in charge, he meaning Trump. And then they're going to bring in some Arab and Islamic countries to police the place. This is the idea. This is a non-starter. It's just not going to work. And by the way, just to take this a step further, a number of countries, Pakistan, Indonesia, for example, who have been mentioned as possible countries that would put peacekeeping forces in Gaza, have said they will not go into Gaza until Hamas is disarmed. And Hamas, of course, is not going to disarm. They'd be crazy to disarm because there is no hope of a political endgame for the Palestinians. There's no self-determination here. If Hamas disarmed, they'd leave themselves wide open to the IDF.
Can Netanyahu claim with a straight face? Suppose we could stop right there and I could just fill in the blank. Can he, anybody could fill in the blank. Can he claim with a straight face that his government is abiding by the Witkoff-Kushner-Trump so-called ceasefire?
Not with a straight face. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Lebanon, if you look at what's happening in Gaza, there's abundant evidence, a superabundant of evidence, that the Israelis are not abiding by the ceasefire. They violated on a consistent basis in Lebanon, and they violated on a consistent basis in Gaza. And what does the United States do in these cases? It stands idly by and allows the Israelis to do whatever they want. We continue to fund them, and we continue to give them equipment and support them diplomatically if they ever get into any trouble.
Just like the Congress of the United States sits idly by and lets the president do whatever he wants, even when he's murdering people on the high seas in the Caribbean Ocean, 1,500 miles from the United States.
That's true. But at least the Congress is beginning to get cold feet. They're beginning to get nervous.
Right.
You don't see any of that in terms of how Trump deals with the Israelis or how Congress deals with the Israelis. And that's basically because, as I've said on numerous occasions, the lobby owns Trump and the lobby owns Congress.
Right. I mean, is there any feasible way to stop these killings, these criminal acts on the Caribbean, other than perhaps scaring Congress into thinking its members will not be reelected once the public sees the murders on film?
That's possible. I'd say the likelihood of that happening is in the range of 5 to 10%.
Wow.
I mean, the truth is, if Congress decided to take the bull by the horns and get tough with Trump, I think he'd just ignore them.
Here's Senator Rand Paul. Actually, earlier today on this, Chris, cut number 10.
We've been doing this for 30 years. When the Coast Guard picks up boats off of Venezuela, which we have done historically, about one in four of the boats, maybe one in five, don't have drugs. So we make mistakes. Are we willing to execute people with a 20% error rate? This is an insane policy. It's inconsistent. It's not war, and it's not the way we've ever done this. Think about it. If we can blow up a boat in the ocean that is at war with us because of the drugs, what about when they get to Miami and they put it in a truck, and the truck's going from Miami to Orlando? Can you shoot a grenade launcher at the truck? No, we arrest people because sometimes we're wrong. You know, the make and the model of the truck is this, and oh, we made a mistake. That was somebody on vacation. We don't blow up people without first arresting them. And this is the way it's been done on the high seas for 100 years or more. And what we're doing now is just plain wrong.
The classic constitutionally faithful clarion cry for something as simple and basic as due process.
I agree. Hard to disagree with anything that Senator Paul said. I would also note that I think that it's very important that people pay attention to the rule of law, both domestically and internationally. I mean, we have laws for good reason. And I understand that sometimes countries have to violate the law because it's in their security. It's in their national interest. It makes sense from a security point of view. But you want to minimize the number of times you do that and otherwise follow the law as much as possible. And the same thing is true at the domestic level. And in this country, with regard to our leadership, and I think it was true at the Biden administration as well, paying attention to the law was just not that important. We thought we could do pretty much whatever we wanted to do. And the only difference between the Biden administration and the Trump administration at the international level is that the Biden administration trumpeted the virtues of the international legal system, the rule of law internationally, while in practice they were stomping all over it. The Trump administration, at least, is consistent. They're constantly railing against the rules-based order or international law, while at the same time traipsing all over it.
Well, see if you can figure out what the president meant here, because first he says we will release the second tape, the tape showing the survivors clinging onto chunks of wood for 45 minutes before they were murdered. And then he said, I never said I'd release the tape, and then he said he wasn't sure what he said. Let's see if you can figure it out. What he means, number 11.
Mr. President, you released video of that first boat strike on September 2nd, but not the second video. Will you release video of that strike so that the American people can see for themselves what
happened? I don't know what they have, but whatever they have, we'd certainly release, no problem.
Mr. President, you said you would have no problem with releasing the full video of that strike on September 2nd off the coast of Venezuela.
Secretary Hegseth now says...
You said that. I didn't say that. The This is ABC Fake News.
You said that you would have no problem releasing the full bit. Okay, well, Secretary Hegseth...
No, whatever Hegseth wants to do is okay with
me. He now says it's under review. Are you ordering the secretary to release that full video?
Whatever he decides is okay with me.
Are you committed to releasing the full video?
Didn't I just tell you that?
You said that it was up to Secretary Hegseth.
You're the most obnoxious reporter in the whole place. Let me just tell you, you are an obnoxious, a terrible reporter.
This is really ridiculous coming from the President of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, what can you say at this point?
All right, let's transition. When the Kremlin agreed to disband the Warsaw Pact, why did the United States stay in NATO?
We stayed in NATO because we understood that we served as a pacifier in Europe, or at least in the western half of Europe. As long as NATO was intact, that meant the United States was there, and it had its security umbrella over the West Europeans. Now, it's very important to understand that when the Soviets disbanded the Warsaw Pact, they were nevertheless content to leave NATO intact. They were content to allow the United States to remain in Europe because the Soviets understood that we did act as a pacifier. And this is especially relevant with regard to West Germany, which was in the process of becoming Germany. Because you remember at the end of the Cold War, Germany was reunified. So the German reunification caused worries all across Europe. People thought that the best way to deal with that potential problem was to keep NATO intact, which meant keep the Americans in Europe. We bought that argument, the Europeans bought that argument, and the Soviets and later the Russians bought that argument. So there's no problem there. Where does the problem come? It comes with NATO expansion.
Right.
You well know, Judge, we told the Soviets that we would not expand NATO. That it would not be expanded eastward. And then the Clinton administration came along and they decided in 1994 that NATO would be expanded. And that is the principal source of the problem today. Had we not expanded NATO, and certainly if we had not expanded NATO or tried to expand NATO into Ukraine, Europe, I believe, would be peaceful today.
Instead, you have argued, this is a great piece, it's at the American Conservative. It probably appears elsewhere. Did you give it as a speech, or did you write it as a as an editorial?
No, I gave it as a speech.
Okay.
Before the European Parliament.
Okay, because I could hear your voice and enjoy, actually rejoice in some of your favorite figures of speech, and you argued so powerfully that Europe's future is bleak. Why do you say that?
Well, it's very bleak for two reasons. One is there's not going to be a happy ending to the Ukraine war. The Russians are going to win an ugly victory. Ukraine is going to be destroyed. And very importantly, relations between Russia on one side and Ukraine and Europe on the other side are going to be poisonous. And they're going to be dangerous because there's always a possibility, given all the flashpoints that exist in Eastern Europe, that a war will break out again. So once the war ends, once the shooting stops and you get some sort of armistice or frozen conflict, the potential for conflict, armed conflict, is still going to be there. And you want to remember you're operating in an environment where there are poisonous relations. The other point, and this is of great importance, is that the United States is pivoting to Asia in a major way. You see this in the new national security strategy that the Trump administration has just put out. We view China as our principal concern, and there's a great deal of emphasis in the administration, and especially with Trump himself, in focusing on East Asia and leaving the Europeans to defend for themselves. So what I'm saying here, Judge, is that if we pivot to East Asia, which I think is likely, the end result is that NATO will definitely collapse, or it certainly will be a shell of its former self. And the end result is that the Europeans will be on their own to provide for their own security. And the Europeans live in fear of that possibility. So I think when you put all these things together, it's a very bleak future for Europe.
So the Sun of London, which is a tabloid, reports just a few minutes ago that a British soldier was killed in Ukraine. Now, Colonel McGregor informs that many British special forces and MI6 have been killed, but none of it's been revealed. This time they revealed it because it happened in some sort of a training accident, and the press was there, and the guy was in uniform. Is this going to affect the Kremlin thinking at all, that a British soldier in uniform was killed in Ukraine?
No, I don't think they're going to care at all, for two reasons. One, I'm sure they already know that there are British soldiers in Ukraine. Not many of them, but some of them. The fact is, the Russians are principally concerned with waging the war on the battlefield. And whether there are 10 British soldiers, 100 British soldiers, or even 1,000 British soldiers just doesn't matter very much. And more importantly, the British are not going to put in 1,000 soldiers. They're not going to directly engage in the fight in any meaningful way. So this just doesn't matter very much.
If you had been a fly on the wall at 10 Downing Street yesterday when Volodymyr Zelensky showed up and was greated by Sir Keir Starmer, President Emmanuel Macron, and Chancellor Merz, what do you think you would have heard? What could they possibly say to him? They can't raise taxes. They can't borrow money. Belgium won't let them steal the money from the Belgian banks. What can they do for him?
Well, unless they can steal that money, those frozen Russian assets from Euroclear, there's hardly anything they can do. Ukraine is certainly doomed if that proves to be the case. So I think what they probably told Zelensky at this point in time is to hold the line, and they would do everything they can to steal that money and make sure that Ukraine gets the $100+ billion that it desperately needs so they can continue the war. I mean, there's no question that the Europeans, much like the Ukrainians, are profoundly committed to keeping this war going. They obviously think that there's some chance that the Russians will collapse before Ukraine collapses, and that we will emerge, we meaning the West, and the Ukrainians will emerge victorious. I think this is tilting at windmills, but it's quite clear that the Europeans seem to believe that.
President Trump, in another one of his rants, we don't have it on tape, apparently said he doesn't like the Europeans, he doesn't trust them, and he's thinking of walking away from Ukraine. Now, he said that before, so I don't know that we can put much credence in it. And we just watched that clip where he said, yeah, release the tape, and 5 hours later denied that he had said it. So these were sort of wild, almost ridiculous, at times hilarious interactions with the press in the Oval Office. I don't think they can really be fairly used as a window into his thinking.
Well, one way of thinking about what's going on, which ties this discussion of Trump to the previous question about the three European leaders and Zelensky, is that everybody now understands that Ukraine is going to lose. And the question is, who's going to get the blame? Who's going to bear the responsibility for the loss? And one could argue that Trump will not simply walk away from Ukraine, because that will then allow the Ukrainians, and especially the Europeans, to blame him for the collapse of Ukraine. So the smart thing for Trump to do in this story is to say, this is a European responsibility, and I will do everything I can to help the Europeans keep the Ukrainians afloat. So that's the Trump perspective. From the European side of the equation, there, I think they want to fight and fight and fight, fight to the last Ukrainian, so they cannot be accused of having bailed out on Ukraine, and can actually make the argument that it's Trump who's responsible for Ukraine's collapse. So what I'm saying to you here is, I have to believe, given what's happening on the battlefield, that the Europeans, and certainly Donald Trump, understand that Ukraine is doomed, that they're going to lose this war, and there's no way of turning the tide. And therefore, the question is a blame game, or the question is who gets the blame? You're involved.
Right. And Trump is a master at deflecting blame.
Oh, he's brilliant at that. And the Europeans are very good at that as well.
Mm.
Because you want to understand that this is going to be a catastrophic defeat. This is not a minor defeat. This is not like losing in Afghanistan, right? This is a major war where Europe and the United States, or NATO more generally, was on one side, and the Russians were on the other.
Well, you know who he'll blame it on. He'll blame it on Biden, and Biden does bear a lot of blame, but he does, Trump as well, for arming the Ukrainians before Biden was in office, and for continuing to arm them after he came to office the second time. Here is this statement, a bizarre statement he made, as if that's news, on Saturday, claiming that President Zelensky hasn't even read the so-called 28-point proposal. There's a little bit more in there. We'll let you see it and hear it now. Chris, number six.
What's your next step in Russia-Ukraine talks after last week's negotiations?
So we've been speaking to President Putin, and we've been speaking to Ukrainian leaders, including Zelensky, President Zelensky. And I have to say that I'm a little bit disappointed that President Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal. That was as of a few hours ago. His people love it, but he hasn't. Russia's fine with it. Russia, I guess, would rather have the whole country when you think of it. But Russia is, I believe, fine with it. But I'm not sure that Zelensky's fine with it. His people love it, but he hasn't read it.
Really crazy. His people don't love it. Russia's not fine with it. How could he know whether or not it's been read? And that was, by the way, Sunday evening. I misspoke when I said Saturday.
The Russians don't accept this 28-point plan. The Ukrainian people, and I assume by that he means all of Zelensky's advisors, all the key national security establishment figures in Ukraine, they don't accept this plan for one second.
Right.
Zelensky himself, I can't believe he hasn't read it. I'm sure he has, but he surely knows what's in it if he hasn't read it, and he completely rejects it. This is what he said yesterday when he talked to the press after meeting with the three European leaders. He doesn't accept the deal. Nobody accepts the deal. That's the problem. There's no deal to be had here.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Now brothers and sisters, we were covering why it is that it's possible for us to not have ikhlas, right? We said that Quranic ikhlas is something else. We discovered that it is impossible to have Quranic ikhlas without considering Allah to be azim and kabir. And many believers, like us, were suffering with the idea that Allah is not kabir. Allah is not azim, not practically. Now, just for clarification, Now, the spiritual teachers have taught us about the bare minimum level of ikhlas that we need to have. The bare minimum, so we don't have to consider ourselves munafiqeen and riyad and stuff like that. The bare minimum amount of ikhlas that we have to have, and that we have and we enjoy, alhamdulillah, is that I do what I'm supposed to do for the sake of Allah. I'm carrying out my duties for the sake of Allah. That level of ikhlas we do have, that's enough, alhamdulillah. Is that the Quranic expectation of ikhlas? No. We have to remind ourselves of where we need to be. What's the Quranic expectation of ikhlas? We studied this verse before. Allah says in the Quran, Surah 6, verse 162, قُلْ, He tells the Prophet, say, إِنَّ صَلَاتِي وَنُسُكِي وَمَحْيَايَ وَمَمَاتِي لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. Quranic ikhlas is the ayat of Quran. Say, truly my prayer and the other acts of worship, my life and my death are lillahi rabbil alameen. So that level of ikhlas, that's not there. Okay. What'll happen if I settle with being mediocre? Instead of pushing for that Quranic level of ikhlas, what happens to the Muslim who settles? If we do settle, brothers and sisters, there's one scary thing that happens. One of the scary things that happens is this. A person who doesn't have Quranic ikhlas goes through life looking for the results of their actions. And this is very scary. I just did this for Allah. What did I get in return? I did the right thing. I'm looking for the results of my actions. And that is deadly. Especially, let's say somebody satisfies himself with this kind of level of ikhlas, instead of the ikhlas that we're looking for, where the responsibility becomes important, and they engage in spiritual wafering. Of course, spiritual wafering is for me to better myself. But if I'm looking for results, that's not what Islam teaches. Let me explain. For a person of ikhlas, my amal and the results are one. What I was trying to do and what I got out of this situation are exactly one. Instead of a person of ikhlas feeling frustrated, the person of with ikhlas feels, I got what I was looking for. The person of ikhlas regards Allah as great, Allah as azim. The other results of the action, that's nurun ala nur. If I get God, that's the prize. Let me tell you how Imam Sajjad tells us to think. This is how he addresses Allah. He says, Ya na'imi wa jannati. Oh Allah, you are my na'im. You are my paradise. Ya dunyaya wa akhirati. You are my dunya. You are my akhirah. The person of ikhlas gets God. And that's what I was looking for. I want to give you a practical example. In Islam, brothers and sisters, we are taught to be tolerant, to put up with people. And it's natural. I'm going through life. There's different cultures, different personalities. We're dealing with individuals. People are sensitive about certain things. Islam teaches us a concept called mudara, to be tolerant. To the extent that I'm able to be flexible without compromising what Allah says, Allah's commanded me to do this. Hadith. The hadith says this. Amarani Rabbi. My Lord commanded me, بِمُدَارَاتِ النَّاسِ كَمَا أَمَرَنِي بِأَدَاءِ الْفَرَائِضِ. Allah commanded me to be tolerant, to work with people, to be flexible, in the same way that He's commanded me to carry out my wajibat. So my red line in flexibility is I can't cross God's red lines in order to make you happy. But otherwise, I try as hard as humanly possible to be able to be tolerant. And now, if a person has ikhlas, let's say I was tolerant
I was in a situation. Somebody else did the wrong thing. I tried to put up with it. I tried to be the better person. I tried to walk a higher path. And the other person didn't do their responsibility. Allah told me to do mudara. I did mudara. The other person didn't do their job. If I'm a person of ikhlas, I got what I was looking for. I got God. I just won. The other person, if they do their job, nurun ala nur. I'm not fixated on the results. I don't get depressed if the results aren't there. If I did what God said, I won. Hadith, and then after that, Masad. This hadith is from Imam Sajjad. He says this, من أحب السبيل إلى الله عز وجل جرعتان. Amongst the most beloved paths to God. Allah is my Jannah. Allah is my dunya. Allah is my akhirah. Amongst the most beloved paths to Allah, he says, are two jur'ah, two drinks. Let's call them two bitter drinks. He says, one of them, jur'atu ghaydhin. One of them is a situation that angers the mu'min. The believer is furious with what just happened. But I did my job. I swallowed my anger. The imam says, Yarudduha bihilmin. The believer did was halim. They did their responsibility. I got what I was looking for. The other one, wajur'atu musibatin. The other one is a catastrophe, a calamity. I did my job. It didn't fix itself. Yarudduha bisabrin. The person of ikhlas is patient. And then I win by doing what Allah said. We ask that Allah accept what was said and heard in His way. We end with salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kari. عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه نعم الحاج أمال to heaven.
welcome back, dear listeners. Keep listening for more wonderful programs right here on Iran Radio from our station in Tehran, Iran. First, we present Youth Station. This program series addresses various topics which are all related to young people, such as youth and contentment, youth and abstinence, youth and friendship, and a lot more. Valuable insights for the younger generation, indeed. Then you listen to another selection from our radio productions. Our next offering is Viewpoints. Brother Atta and Sayyid Ali Mereshi will lead an analytical roundtable discussion of various religious, political, cultural, and social issues of the Islamic world today. In this program, we pay particular attention to the mainstream news of the Islamic issues and Muslim lands. Thought-provoking discussions from Viewpoints. Following that, we bring you The Key, hosted by Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha. This program presents short answers to doubts and ambiguities raised about the various Islamic and Shia topics, so don't miss a bit. Coming up, it's time for Youth Station.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to this episode of Youth Station. My name is Muhammad and I am here with Sister...
This is Nahid, having the honor of being with you.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid. We are talking about the disposable culture in our youths, amongst us, the Gen Zs. And we did talk about boundaries the last time. And we did believe that there is no yes or no answer to this, but it depends on the situation. Exactly what are boundaries? That's like the most conflicting discussion. Should I keep this or should I throw this away? What really makes me decide either of the two? Should I fix it or should I get a new one? What really makes me decide between these two? What is that line, that thin line between me saying yes to it or no to it? And we did talk about, for example, toxic relationships. If you think that's really toxic and you can't fix it, it's fine. Move on. Yeah, it's fine. There is no problem in saying no to a relationship which you can't. That's why, although it's like extremely discouraged, it's displeasureful, it's not something that you might like. That's why we have the door of, for example, in marriages, divorce. If you really can't fix that marriage, fine, you can. But it should be your last resort. Try to fix it as much as you can. Blocking harmful content. Well, you know it's a harmful thing. A specific music, a specific video, a specific, you know, person who gives lectures on things that you know he's a harmful person. Avoid it, block it. There is no problem with that. But then we understand the two extremes. We know that this extreme is extremely bad. We were talking about the other end. We talked about treating people like replaceable apps. Now, this end, of course, you shouldn't treat people as if they're apps you can easily replace. Avoiding discomfort or repair in general. Now, let me challenge with another thing while we are at it. Losing patience with imperfect or imperfect things in people.
And this is happening. The young people today are not patient enough with the opposite idea, with the even they cannot defend themselves well, and it's really sad. As part of my class, always, since I teach them language, as part of my class, I have this ritual, this routine, that whatever question I ask my students, there's a why after it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that a few years ago, I realized that our students, even in the diploma exam, I mean, even in the moment that they should be, as if they can talk about every perspective, they should be able to know the language, and even in their own mother language. Once we question the new generation with why, or defend yourself, or talk about your idea, or prove it right, they fail. They don't want to, or they don't know how to.
Just impatient.
Yeah, and
simply impatient.
Yeah, they don't want us to just tell them why. They don't want us to ask them questions because they are unable to just tolerate the negative idea or tolerate the facial expression which shows I'm shocked by what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So this is happening, and we see lots of young people who don't want to assert how they feel, or they just want to keep safe by just being patient with the things that they believe in. And once it comes to the other people, impatient, intolerable, and they wouldn't even just spill one word of the thing that they are thinking about, because they don't want to be tolerant with the opposing ideas.
I think this is extremely important in families as well. We had a few episodes about parents and expecting things from parents. It's also important that we be patient in our relationships, both in with our children, with our spouse, with our parents, with our other relatives amongst us. We have to be patient with them, because there are certain things you can fix about them. Yeah. There are certain things you can't fix about them, but there are certain things that, for the things that you can't fix about them, tolerate it. That doesn't make them necessarily a bad person, because there are things that you need to fix yourself in your life.
And when it comes to discipline, I think. I mean, at school once, I asked one of the students who was 10 years old, he hated school. And I told him, why do you hate school? He said, because I have to stay here for the day. I have to be here for some hours. See how impatient these people are, that the youngest, say, member of the society says, I don't want to tolerate this atmosphere. I don't want to be kept here. And this concept of discipline comes with it. Mm-hmm. And those who feel like, okay, once I feel safe the whole time, I'm going to be more successful. Exactly. This is the wrong kind of idea.
And I think it all comes back again with us being patient and tolerant and sacrificial. And once again, the family issue is something that is really bothering me, because you see the rate of divorces these days. And it's something that really bothers any sound mind.
It's like the blocking culture is happening in the families.
Exactly. The disposable culture is now among the spouses.
Right.
Now, I speak to some of my teachers who are basically consultants for family affairs.
Yeah.
And they tell me that you'd be astonished at some of the reasons why young couples, they come to us and they tell us, why is the reason that they want to get the divorce? For example, this guy, when he comes home, he does not put his clothes in the right place. Or this, my wife, she doesn't cook food properly. Come on, what is this? This is bare impatience. This is the bare minimum of living with someone, is tolerating certain mistakes. Even mistakes that they don't accept.
Once you married them, you had to know that person's not going to be perfect.
Exactly, and just like you're not perfect.
You.
Yeah, just like you're not perfect.
Yeah.
There are no two perfect persons in the world. Well, except for the infallibles, we learn from them how to tolerate each other. When one person becomes two, there are two opinions, there are two cultures, there are two favorites, there are two different things. They're two opinions.
Yeah,
they're completely
in the simplest
different.
Way, two human beings, two different people.
Exactly. So they're both of them have minds. Both of them have thought processes that should be, respected. Both of them go through difficulties in their life. The sister who is at the home might be going through difficulties that the man who is working in the workplace is not going through, and likewise, vice versa. The person who is working in the workplace might be going through difficulties that the sister might not be imagining. Understand each other. Appreciate each other. Whenever the anger crouches into your life, encroaches in your life, put it down, take a step back, think about it, be tolerant. Yes, he might be wrong. She might be wrong. Fine. You were wrong many times as well. Just tolerate it. Even if you can't fix it. Those situations which you can sit down and talk, perfect, ideal. Sit down, talk, get this done, get this through. It's perfect. But in those situations where either of them are stubborn, or both of them are stubborn,
bear it.
It's fine. You don't have to have a perfect spouse. There is no such thing as whatever I tell him or her, she's going to listen,
sure,
or he's going to listen. It's fine. Tolerate it. It's okay for you to not have the perfect food with the one-star, two-star Michelin food coming to your plate. It's okay if the guy does not listen to you when you tell him to put his clothes in the right place or whatever the case is. It's very naive for you to now be married and then come back. And I think this is something extremely important we should tolerate as young couples, because we see the divorce rate in the generation before us as close to zero.
Yeah,
like how many times have you seen parents and grandparents, you know, you heard from them, okay, that person divorced. It's very, you know, probably cases whereby it's deserving to get divorced. But now, very simple things, just because of intolerance.
Yeah, and on the other side of the coin, we have this emotional avoidance as well. We see people even not daring to start a relationship, even not daring to marry because they are afraid.
Exactly.
What if the person I will marry will not accept my ideas? What if one day he will come home and say something that I don't like? How am I going to react? Am I going to end the relationship off the cuff? Or am I going to bear it? How am I going to bear it? So we have this scare as well. Many of the young people today, not all of them, but many of them are scared of this emotional bond. Because they avoid it, because they're scared of the moments that they have to be of tolerant of each other, the moments that they have to sometimes forget about what they believe in or just try to get along with the other party.
Exactly. So let's talk more about the boundaries, because we challenged the boundaries with a lot of phrases, with a lot of scenarios.
Yeah, sure.
Let's talk more about the boundaries between disposing things and keeping things, inshallah, after we take a short break. Don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, and let's move on to the boundaries. What are the boundaries, and how can I define my limitations, say, the things that are going to define my understanding of this culture? If we say we cannot answer the question as if this ideology, this mindset is either good or bad, so how am I going to define it for myself to take advantage of it? Okay.
Exactly. Should I throw it or should I keep it? What
yeah.
really makes that decision? And let me challenge you. Let me put out some more challenging scenarios. The consumer culture. It trains us to upgrade rather than fix that thing. Keep getting the most latest model. You find your computer, it's fine, working for you, good. Should you spend more money on your